You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
It's funny, like, you press the record button and even though we're just testing them, we're like, oh, now we have to have a recorded conversation.
This will be on the podcast.
Yeah. Okay.
It'll be a bonus episode that everyone's going to really care about, really. What we did on our holidays. This is so strange. It's so funny, like, recording. I mean, obviously, we've done it once before, but it's
that is funny that this time we're both in Melbourne when neither of us live in Melbourne
anymore. It's ridiculous. And you've recently been in Sydney when I wasn't there, and yeah. I've recently been in Canberra when you weren't there.
And we've timed this very well.
It's the 29th of August, 2017. I'm Benjamin Riley.
And I'm Simon Copland.
Welcome to Queers. This episode is going to be something a little bit different. Simon and I are joined by writer and troublemaker, Helen Razor. Hi, Helen.
Good evening, / morning, / afternoon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess we have no idea when people are going to be listening to this. Hopefully, you know, at home in an intimate space.
With a glass
couple
of
candles on.
Perhaps aggressively jogging down a scenic track. Being absolutely spurred on by our words of revolution that I can promise you will follow.
So running straight from that track into a... I don't know, we rarely kind of incite people to very specific actions. So Helen, how did you find out about the podcast?
The first time you both came to my attention was a rather wonderful piece that you wrote in the publication Overland, which occasionally does have wonderful pieces.
It certainly does.
Most often, though, I'd say had pieces desperately trying to redefine the left as something that has nothing to do with the mode of production whatsoever. But there are still really great pieces. And your piece was really good. And I thought, considering your relative youth, that you made some asides about, you didn't relegate the idea of identity politics or intersectionality to irrelevance, but you questioned its efficacy. And I mean, to say that, you know, identity politics or its very close cousin, intersectionality is meaningless, is itself meaningless. I mean, of course, people have identities and of course those identities produce social meaning. But the fact that you challenged that in a publication which has largely embraced the idea, I thought was quite good. So that's how I heard not so much about the podcast, but the extraordinary young identities that are Simon and his lovable sidekick, Ben.
I'm absolutely the sidekick in this relationship. That is true.
That was completely arbitrary.
Speaking of...
You're clearly the top in this working relationship.
Well, I'm probably like twice Simon's size.
It's true.
You know.
I forgot how tall you were until we saw each other again.
Look, enough with the relentless media habit about talking about ourselves as though we're fascinating. We are not. We are mere vessels for ideas. But let's talk about some things of substance, shall we?
Yeah, let's. I mean, I think it's good that we started talking about identity politics just a second ago. I mean, yeah. I think, like us, in many ways, you have a bit of a reputation for being sort of a contrarian when it comes to queer politics.
But I'm not a contrarian. Like yourself, I have what I consider a consistent position.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's informed, just entre nous, a little bit secret, quite a lot by Marxism, but also queer politics. So I'm not inconsistent with queer theory.
Yeah, so I guess maybe
informed
I'm
by queer
thinking
theory.
About contrarian in terms of such of the mainstream discourse of...
Critic. Critical.
It's just a word that I think is incorrectly used. I mean, yeah. I have, I have a particular view. And there are, I mean, of course, the view changes the more one reads and the more one ages and, you know, the more sort of like the idea of praxis starts to interfere with your theory.
Sure.
But in no way am I contrary. I'm actually fairly predictable.
Okay. That's the other thing. I mean, I think that's totally fair. So maybe, to get into the substance, let's go into what is your consistent perspective and particularly, I guess, thinking about the sort of, you know, where queer politics is at and a sort of practical level in Australia today, where I think we all have probably significant disagreements with the way it operates. you know, what is the sort of critical position you take on a lot of the things that are occurring today in queer politics?
Well, I would say that it's, and this can occur with identity politics as well, it's actually a disavowal of the notion of politics itself. It's kind of more, I mean, although a lot of people within so-called queer politics would consider themselves to be very progressive, it is, in my view, informed by a really sort of like quite old-fashioned, by which I mean centuries-old Western Enlightenment version of what truth and honour is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, what's the most ethical thing to do? And, you know, these conversations and these writers like, you know, Immanuel Kant or whatever took place in the salons of Europe among the elite. Some great philosophy developed out of that time. But, I mean, it is, you know, you do go back and you sort of consider things like Kant and it's like, you know, the categorical imperative. It's like, you know, you should proceed from goodwill, which is part of the categorical imperative. You know, yeah. This is my ethics. As long as I, the individual, proceed from a place of goodwill and understanding and, you know, follow the golden rule, do unto others, then I will achieve political action. But a couple of things happen, or a couple of things have happened. One is that these were conversations. These conversations are very Western, and you know they have a long tradition, and they occur in small places where you know they're talking about men of goodwill, but it was just a handful of men of goodwill, and they were implicitly there's the assumption, you know, they were the people that were going to govern and inform. The rest of society, and I think that that's something that we can see in queer politics. The most a public recent example of this was this youngish journalist called Shannon Malloy, journalist of you know I think little note until such time as he began to describe the bullying that he, a person who identifies as a gay man, had encountered at school, as, you know, most people who have a non-normative sexuality do. And it was a defensive safe school. So it was something that was just, you know, embraced quite quickly by, you know, gays and their allies. Because, I mean, don't the allies just... look, crave a gay pet at the moment.
Oh, no more lucrative status to attain than being a capital A ally.
I was in the city here in Melbourne on Saturday, just after the rally that had occurred, and I saw lots of people walking around with stickers that said ally. And I just cringed at every moment I saw it.
May as well say straight.
Yeah.
I was... he should remain nameless, but I was speaking to an eminent older scholar. I was talking to him and he was talking about doing a recent round of interviews for one of his many books. The interviewers were very careful always to say, I support you, but I'm not gay. And I sort of feel the same with ally.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, seriously, you're telling me all of your sexual practice is normative? Like, you've never had a finger stuck up your bum? You know, it's like, ally. You know, just don't mistake me for one of you.
I've got to be apart from, over here apart, and we have to be separate, but I have to, you know, and I'm just supporting you, but I'm separate.
Of course, it's not all their fault, because for a long time in, you know, sort of more orthodox gay politics, you know, you really had to set forth your credentials. And I'm old enough to remember when, I mean, look, let's be frank, there's still a lot of transphobia in large gay communities.
Of course, absolutely.
And it's just that through certain admirable efforts of, you know, a small number of people, that it's no longer acceptable to say those things out loud. But there's been a lot of people, you know, relegated to silence and chucked out of the queer community. By the same token, I found that the queer community was a lot more tolerant in the 90s. And, you know, it's just interesting, the idea, the way that people think of Stonewall. I mean, these were people not necessarily with identities.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I mean,
yeah.
There was, and now they're being described as trans or not really being asked.
Totally.
Well, if they're still alive.
I listened to an interview recently with someone who's now considered, and I think by the end of her life called herself a trans woman who was there at Stonewall. And the this was an interview recorded in like the 80s, and the interviewer introduced her by saying that she will use some language that makes it sound like she's a drag queen. But you know, that's a function of how it was talked about at the time. But what was interesting to me was the fact that it was deemed necessary to, like, you know, almost like have this caveat at the start of the episode.
I find that quite interesting about drag queens. I mean, there's still a lot of older gay men in particular who are happy to identify as drag queens. And they're gay men. Like, they identify as gay men, but they are, you know, drag queens. That's what they do. And that's no longer acceptable in the, you know, the BLT sandwich, you know, is really interesting to me. But so I find, just sort of like back to the idea of these old Enlightenment politics how we the good, we the elite, can decide for you, the rest of the population, what that is, you know, implicit in a lot of this thinking, or, you know, really visible on a show like The West Wing. Have you ever seen The West Wing?
Yes, absolutely. Indeed.
And it's, you get these kind of like great progressives like marching down halls being really, really excellent at what they do. And the so-called liberal left are like mad for these people. Like, you know, they're great and they have rational arguments. And if we only elevate the excellent, and if only we have role models, then everything will be okay. And you can understand how in, you know, a time where people were still virtually enslaved and there was, you know, no suffrage for many people, that this could function. You know, a group of elite men say, well, we've decided this is the way to be moral, and then everybody else has to take it on. But we are purportedly living in more democratic times, although, of course, we're not. And so, you know, the question becomes, does this sort of 18th century morality really fit with a mass society? You know, I mean, you can't just say that, you know, things that appear to be moral in our everyday conversations are things that can then transform the world. You know, I think, I can't remember, but was it Marcuse who came up with this great analogy, you know, the Frankfurt School, and you guys like the Frankfurt School, right?
Simon's better on theorists than
I mean, they're largely blamed for, but I think wrongly, for the movement toward identity politics. I think neoliberalism is largely responsible for identity politics, but there you go. So I think
I agree with that too, but let's...
I think that Marcuse, it could have been him, I don't know. I'm not great on theorists either. I have a terrible memory. So he uses this example of the traffic jam, right, to explain the difference between individual action and individual morality, and then, you know, mass consciousness, which are two very different things, or like mass political consciousness. So you go home at 5 p.m. and actually that's the sensible thing for you to do. You don't want your boss to extract any more profit out of your body. You should go home at 5 p.m. And you go home at 5 p.m. and, you know, like most people, you're a safe and sensible driver and you're observing the road rules. But, you know, what happens? The mass then takes on its own character, and there will be accidents. And so there seems to be, like, not just in queer politics but in contemporary liberal feminism and a range of other so-called progressive movements, this inability to see beyond the individual and individual greatness. It's like, if we just one voice, just one heartrending YouTube, just one Guardian editorial that says, we will not conscience any arguments against the sanctity of same-sex marriage, etc., which I think is a fucked up thing to do, that, you know, if only we as individuals all, you know, proclaim this thing, then nothing will change. And then, you know, everybody believes it all, well, not everybody, but a large number of people believe that it all starts with me.
Sure.
Now, I'm not just talking, so you know where I'm coming from a theoretical standpoint here. And I'm very aware in saying this that I'm a sort of a white tertiary educated woman, which I think are reasonable, you know, identity politics notwithstanding, are very reasonable admissions to make when one is speaking. this is one of the good things that, you know, constructivism and identity politics gave us. You know, we are all informed by our identities. So I know that it's a privilege of having a privileged identity to ignore identity. So sure. I'm just sort of making that that caveat. And you know, for example, a friend of mine who's an Aboriginal scholar said at dinner the other night, sometimes I get sick of speaking as an Aboriginal person because sure. there are so few contexts in which he gets to speak as anything else. And, you know...
That's such an interesting point.
Yeah, and whites get to enjoy a fluidity of conversation, you know, move across borders more easily and conversational borders more easily, pretending, like Chris Kenny does, that identity doesn't really exist simply because we don't feel it. So, you know... Identity exists, identity exists, identity exists.
I mean, I was going to ask you, you sort of talk, like, obviously, the ideas that you're talking about and this kind of focus on the individual has its kind of roots in some very old ideas. But I almost got the sense when you were talking about the 90s, for example, that I mean, is this new in terms of, like, the last few decades of queer politics? And if so, do you have any idea on kind of why this focus has become so extreme?
Well, I think, you can't sort of separate, and increasingly you can't separate queer culture from the mainstream culture.
Yes.
In the 90s, when I was, you know, coming into adulthood, there was actually a distinct cultural separation, which is both good and bad. And the community that I lived in Sydney was one where you could live, and, you know, this wasn't for the sake of living in an echo chamber, it was just out of safety, where you could live in a queer community. And you got all sorts of interesting ways of living and networks of care that happened. And, you know, we know that this happened right around the Western world. And was his name Martin Delaney, the great yep. guy who, you know, that dreadful film, The Dallas Buyers Club, basically ripped off his life story. I mean, he was a guy that used the queer community and queer doctors to accelerate a way to live with HIV.
Yeah, like, I mean, HIV is a great example of queer communities coming together.
It's an extraordinary history-changing example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of activism. It's okay, well, we're going to have lay researchers and we're going to have these informal, you know, medical tests and what have you. And that genuinely accelerated by years and saved goodness knows how many lives. The antiviral combination therapy, which I think was available in 1996. And so, you know, these things went on in secret. And of course, yes, you know, we're a mass society and people shouldn't be ghettoized and stuff like that. But that kind of ghettoization enabled some kind of separate thought. And the fact that people were dying.
Yes.
Made it very, people were dying, you know, and it's, you know, before your eyes, and it was a death sentence. So that changed things a lot. And I mean, you know, and then you have this fundamentalist soundtrack, and everyday people who really believed that this was, you know, some kind, even if they weren't Christian, that this was some kind of punishment for the dirty, dirty acts.
Mm.
And so that really, I guess, made the queer community much more insular, much more inclined to find different arrangements. And you had things like, I mean, I don't know if they still exist, they probably do in some form or another, you know, like drag houses, you know, with you know, you had a drag mother.
The New York bull culture, which is really, I think it still exists in big cities like New York.
Mm.
I think that's definitely true. That cliched, you create your own family kind of thing.
But it's real. It was real.
Yeah, it is real. Yeah, I sort of use the word cliche because it's what RuPaul says in Drag Race a lot. But I don't think it's. I think it's cliched in that context. But in those circumstances,
I mean, I quite like that show. It's fun.
Me too. Yeah, we've talked about it on the but you know that sort of actually creating, you know, the you know, when you're forced, when you don't have your own family necessarily, your own biological family, you do create your own families and create your own culture and your own, you know, communities and all of that sort of stuff. And the drag ball scene is a perfect example.
And
of
there
that.
Were really, you know, they may have been informal, but they were absolutely solid networks of care. I'm not saying that it was a utopia, and I'm not saying that it was probably a lot. I mean, my memory is that there were a lot more gay bashings than there are today in Sydney. I mean, that may or may not be true. I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, at the same time, you may had one police liaison officer instead of all police officers sort of trained, which, you know, was also, like, very useful for people in... I remember when the first gay liaison officer was appointed at the Darlinghurst Police Station. And a lot of what that person had to do was actually, you know, intervene in, you know, gay family violence, which, of course, goes on. Why wouldn't it? We're not fucking perfect, are we? But so, you know, you have this hostile environment around you, but within that environment, and again, I'm not saying things were better in my day. They certainly weren't in many respects. But so what has occurred now is there's no honouring of that time, and there's no instruction being taken from that time. And, you know, even an organisation that was great and I'm sure is still great, like ACON, you know, I mean, you look at the awards that ACON give out.
Famously to Karl Stefanovic last year.
But also, I mean, Karl Stefanovic is like the least of it. Look at the number of people in the fucking finance sector that we choose to praise for their diversity and inclusion. Can there be a less inclusive industry? And I'm not just talking in terms of the people that are employed, but can there be an industry more damaging to queer community itself than the finance sector? Poverty is a huge issue. Homelessness is a huge issue amongst queers.
These are barely concerns, I think, now in certainly in like mainstream queer discourse.
But I mean it's they're not concerns at all. I mean, who sets the prizes for housing? It's banks and shadow banks. And this, in Australia in particular, this is a massive problem.
It's a major issue, yeah.
And, I mean, queer people were vulnerable from the outset to homelessness. I mean, I experienced it as a teenager myself. You know, there's nowhere to go. There's no affordable housing. And especially in, you know, where the queer community, Australia's biggest queer community, was centred, which was and still is, I guess, in inner city Sydney. Now it's just a dream of equity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or it's people who aspire to, you know, equity. And these things, I think, in my view, can't be divorced. Like, just as earlier I said, well, you know, I'm a white, cis, tertiary educated woman, and this is something that I must disclose, you know, because I'm aware that there's things that I will leave out of my story. It is not objective, etc., etc. Your fucking equity is part of your story, you know? I mean, the amount of property that you own is part of your story. And this is the thing that we don't look at. It's capital and how much of it you have. And what your vested interests are. And this thing, capital, that influences and coerces the lives of every person on the planet is the thing that we choose to ignore, which is my major problem with identity politics / queer politics. It's like a capital, oh, well, it's just another thing. No, it's not just another thing. It's a totalizing thing. And if you don't have sandwiches to eat and if you don't have anywhere to live, you'll certainly feel it. And, you know, in one sense, I'm quite happy for my relative poverty because at least it sort of reminded me, because you don't make a lot of money being a Marxist news analyst, and especially you don't make a lot of money if you've been writing kind of like antagonistically for 10 years about marriage equality. You know, I mean, I've been called a homophobe by so many people. And, you know, I don't feel sorry for me or whatever. I don't give a shit. I'm not going to write a book about all of the hate mail that I've received, unlike many other people. I must be right because people are saying violent things toward me. You know, no, I'm not right because people say violent things toward me. I'm right because I'm fucking right.
I mean, given that we're talking, I mean, you're talking now about problems that are like so massive in scale and really obviously go far, far, far beyond queer communities. Like, what would like radicalizing, I'm not even radicalizing, but just like getting the queer community interested in these things look like? I mean, what would harnessing kind of queerness or the way that we kind of name ourselves as a community or the way that we name ourselves as being a special kind of interest group with special political needs to engage them in well, it might, the kind of problems you were talking about look like.
It might help if, you know, those needs other than marriage equality were enumerated. And it might help if you didn't see people of, you know, allegedly good repute writing four storied newspapers about how marriage equality will end suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, sure. I mean, that's how do you know? And I mean, I was...
There's just no evidence to that at all.
I mean, it's really post hoc reasoning. It's the idea is that people who are married tend to live longer. Ergo, this will automatically translate to that. And I mean, there's even been people who've said that suicide rates amongst LGBTQIA people have receded in the US since the passage of by the SCOTUS.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
I mean, seriously? And at what point did you actually start declaring somebody's sexuality on as a coroner on their death certificate?
Mm.
Now, that doesn't happen. And you know what? There are people within psychiatry. There are a lot of really incredibly enlightened people within psychiatry. You know, a lot of really great people. Mental health is another big thing for me. You know,
well, for Simon and I as well.
Yeah. Yeah, but not just, you know, my own obviously failing mental health, but the mental health of nations, you know, the mental health of people, and how they can, you know, seek assistance for it. But I was speaking with a psychiatrist who was, you know, I wanted to examine this idea about suicidality and actual suicide in LGBTIQA people. I think I made the crack. It's like, well, it's not like, you know, it's recorded on the death certificate. And she said, yes, but I think it should be. And I thought, a declaration of your sexuality on a...
I mean, even I think, you know, this is just a theory, but I would assume that a large number of people who are queer in some form who commit suicide might not even be at the stage of being out, let alone, you know, be able to, you know, because that would be the kind of times, you know, for young people who don't feel comfortable coming out, you couldn't even declare that.
But I'm sure there's a lot of people like me who are not even kind of like out in a classic sense. Absolutely. It's like, I don't know, I just
do things.
I do stuff that, you know, sometimes it feels good and sometimes it doesn't. Hopefully, but I mean, more of the time it does.
That's one of the things we've spoken about, you know, I think the sort of the essentialism of there is just one identity that you have and that you just, that you can realign to it, so to the point where it could be on a death certificate, where it's just like...
Well, I think suicidality itself becomes another sort of vector for essentializing queer people or, you know...
The other interesting thing is that I find, so, you know, yes, many tests have found that people who, and, you know, ARCHES, the Australian Centre for Sexuality and Health Research at La Trobe have done, you know, a lot of extensive work on this. And it's actually interesting if you dig down into the data, like the difference between the likelihood that a gay man will have suicidal thoughts and a trans person.
Yes, yeah.
Is actually quite vast.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, gay men are less inclined than trans people, and, you know, and that sort of stuff is not really discussed. And, you know, it can quite often be people who have identities that are less culturally acceptable and less culturally acceptable within the LGBTIQA community.
Yeah, yeah. Because if you're going back to that thing about seeking your own family, if you try to go and seek a family in the queer community and then you get rejected from there, I can imagine, you know, that's the kind of thing that would push you even further on along that path of rejection.
But, I mean, one of the things that I find weird, right, like this bloody same-sex marriage thing. I mean, of course I'll vote yes if, you know, the magpies aren't swooping near the mailbox. But the thing that strikes me as quite odd, we actually have something in terms of, you know, national consensus that is, I'm sorry, this is not whataboutery. This is a much more important thing for Australian law and the national psyche, which is coming to terms with, you know, the foundation myth, the racist foundation myth of Australia. And, you know, Aboriginal people, despite what you read in the press, do not all agree with Noel Pearson. And we've seen recently that Aboriginal people want treaty and were happy to forego the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum to talk about what they wanted and not to make the same mistakes that they felt had been made in 1967, which was, you know, still the result of, like, great bravery by people like Faith Bandler and whatever. So this is a much more pressing issue, and it's something that receives relatively little press. It's something that people like to say, oh, well, you know, just recognise. And here, you know, Stan Grant says recognise, and Noel Pearson, although I think we've chucked Noel Pearson out of the respectable basket temporarily since he dared to say the truth about the ABC, which that it was shit in terms of its treatment of Indigenous people. But, you know, and Adam Good says recognise and blah, 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 you know, no... you know, true discussion about the incredible conversations going on in the Aboriginal community with, you know, like extraordinary young intellectuals. Like, I believe you met her, Nayuka Gori.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, bright young firebrand, that one.
I know she's been quite critical of things like constitutional.
Oh, yeah, yeah, really, really critical. And, you know, she's clearly a scholar of history. She's really great. And so, okay, so here we have a group of people that we know actually whose lives end in suicide. Like, we know that. It's not speculation. And who's having that conversation about the referendum, the upcoming referendum, and the potential harm that it may do to the Aboriginal community?
No, I mean, I can't remember that view ever being expressed.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I'm sorry, it's much more acceptable to be a white homosexual than it is to be a black person, especially an Indigenous person in Australia. It's way more acceptable. You know, if the unlikely happened and an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person became the head of Goldman Sachs, you know, which is highly unfucking likely, right? Sure. I mean, what's going to what's going to happen? I mean, something very different. It's not going to be celebrated in quite the same way.
But it speaks. I feel like that speaks to the kind of the strangeness of queer identities and queer politics generally. In that, you know, that like we can have such a, because respectability politics plays such a kind of big role in our communities, and you can have people at the very sort of top end who can, I don't know, pass or like really fit in with dominant ideologies. I mean, but you still see like a massive spectrum of advantage and privilege and disadvantage within our communities that makes it
also to a lesser extent exists in Indigenous communities. Just talking about from the range of Noel Pearson's to people who are in rural communities. To me, that says something about identity politics and the challenges and the issues of collecting people amongst an identity and expecting a collective politic. And I think right at the start you talked about the sort of the removal of politics from identity politics in many ways, that there's sort of a removal of political, there's sort of this idea of that, you know, we just have to, you know, do express ourselves individually, and that is what expresses our, you know, who we are. And a lot of rights discourse is that removal of politics as well. And sort of, let's go into, like, I just want to go in, I don't know, go into that a bit more about this sort of removal of politics and how.
Sure, but again, we have to say that it occurs at every level.
Absolutely,
it's you know, at epidemic proportions within liberal feminism, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. And I was just using those as examples.
I was running a speech about the media's treatment of Trump and Clinton recently, and sort of did a lot of reading, especially around your sort of like Amanda Mercus and what have you, who said that, you know, the only reason that Hillary didn't get in was that she was a woman. The flip side of that, of course, is that the only reason she should get in is that she's a woman. And I was reading a piece by Jane Caro recently that said, I might not agree with all of her policies. She didn't nominate which. I don't know whether it was campaigning to end the welfare state in the 1990s or campaigning for the incarceration of people of colour in the 1990s. I don't know whether it was ruining the state of Libya, whether it was her work with the prison complex or the military-industrial complex. She didn't nominate which thing it was that Hillary did that she didn't like, but nonetheless, it was essential for our future that Hillary Clinton became president. And, you know, that's as far as the critique goes, you know, and so it's not a political critique.
No, it's not.
But it also becomes, you know, very much, you know, as much as people on the, you know, sort of the old centre left, like Jane, presumably, you know, and she's a good woman and everything. But as much as they might be sort of like grappling and really enacting to say the right initials, LGBTIQ, oh, you've added another initial this week, A, okay, I'll stick with that. And as much as they might be trying to be inclusive in all of those ways, what she doesn't acknowledge in that is the fact of class or of capital, which, again, you know, afflicts every person on the planet, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, how can you not look at any movement? And this is the only problem I have with identity politics. It doesn't think about class and it doesn't think about capital. I think it was, like, I don't agree with all of his politics, but he's a good speaker and occasionally a very good writer. You know, Yiannis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece,
yes,
said that simple truth that now not many people on the so-called left agree with. You can't, to have a conversation about politics without the economy is toxic, and vice versa. And to have a politics without politics is equally toxic. So it's not politics. It's sort of like forcing people to, you know, accept you. I have a friend called Amal Awad, who just wrote a book, really good book, actually, great book, on Arab women. I think she was, it's called Beyond the Veil Cliché. And so it's specifically about Arab women, not Muslim women, which was a good strategy. And, you know, she's written really, really great book. And I remember the Essential poll had come out about a year ago, and Amal just, you know, had a little bit of a rage on SBS, which is, so the Essential poll said that 55% of Australians just don't like Muslims.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, and my friend Amal's response was, oh, who cares? You know, it's like, do I care if Mrs. Kafoops from, you know, Balcombe Hills likes me or not? No, frankly, I don't. I mean, there's always going to be cultural division. I don't think that there will ever be a time of utopia. There will always be people who disapprove,
yes,
of others.
Kind of, it's a sort of difference.
Yeah, and when it comes to gender and sexuality, I mean, I think that it's possible. It's not probable, but I think that it's a possibility that, you know, if we transformed the world, we could probably get rid of the ill of racism for good. It would require some extraordinary transformation. And by the way, nothing of it has to do with pamphlets and telling people they're wrong.
Sure.
It requires an absolute reorganization of the way we order our politics and economy. But getting rid of prejudice, or whatever you want to call it, like revulsion for non-normative gender or non-normative sexuality, that's a different matter. It goes deeper. You know, it's not just that sexuality is a construction, and it's not just that gender is a construction. Don't look at me like that. I'm not saying that it's biologically essential.
No.
I'm not saying that at all, but it's something that begins in infancy. And so it happens at the psychoanalytic level. It doesn't just happen at the social level. And, you know, when that bloke punches you because what he actually wants to do is kiss you, that might happen for a long time, even into a utopian future.
Sure. And like forcing everyone into years and years of therapy is less an option.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have therapy for anything.
Sure.
Anyway, you know, who can afford therapy?
For the most basic mental health issues.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean,
let alone for your repressed sexuality.
You know, you've got delusional disorder and you think that the Martians are stealing your laundry. You try to get a bed in a hospital, you just can't.
Mm.
And so there's this idea about re-educating people, and if only they see, you know, our 18th century Enlightenment truth, they'll agree. Well, no, there might actually be reasons that precede the social, that might come from infancy, that you have a particular idea of man, woman, or not man, woman, or you have a particular idea of same-sex acts or whatever. This is something that's much more complex and doesn't only belong to the social realm, that belongs very much to the personal realm.
I mean, do you think that makes respectability politics a more sort of dangerous prospect within queer communities than potentially in other communities, if it's like denying something that is more fundamental or trying to distance ourselves from something that is more fundamental?
I don't know. The interesting thing for me is like when the actual sex comes up, that's when people lose their shit. Okay, loathe the guy, but Yiannopoulos, right? We all remember why Yiannopoulos finally lost his respectability.
Yes, indeed.
Because, and okay, yeah, so he was talking about like sucking the cock of a priest when he was 13. Shocking, I understand. But you know, like everybody's on Milo. Like so many reasons to hate Milo, like so many other reasons. One that said that I was 13 and I enjoyed sucking the cocks of older men. That was not the reason to, like, absent him. There were many, many other reasons.
Yes.
But that was the reason that he became dangerous.
Do you think that's a kind of, like, something that should point us towards, like, being more... I mean, I don't even know if this has, like, this is just an end in and of itself or whether it's means just something else. But, like, just being more in people's face about our sex lives, about not necessarily our specific sex lives, but... the fact that, like, being queer means you usually have sex differently or, you know, that there are sexual differences here.
So you're asking, Ben, you know, should we be more...
Well, is there political value?
I don't know.
In that, I guess?
Marcuse would say so, but let me just... I was just reading something in my favourite newspaper, The Guardian, and, I mean, you know, to quote the old, you know, Gore Vidal... there are no heterosexual or homosexual people. There are just heterosexual or homosexual acts. Like, to say I'm gay and I do this, well, that's not for me, like, a queer politics, a queer theory way of approaching it. And I was reading this thing. I just want to read out. I mean, you know, very well-intentioned piece about how understanding this author is and how understanding her children are about the gays. It's written by, I think, a couple of months ago in The Guardian by Catherine, the Sydney academic Catherine Lumby, and it's about safe schools, right? Okay, safe schools, not a terrible idea. So she talks about Tony Abbott, and she says Abbott's issue is that safe schools opens young people up to discussions about gender and sexuality fluidity, which, according to the Abbotts and Bernardis of the world, might teach them to be gay. And then she goes on to say, fun fact, approximately 0% of LGBTI people learned their identity from a textbook. They were born that way.
Mm.
No lessons required. Now, this is weird because I think Catherine is about my age. So she would have gone, and I know she went to the same university as I did, Sydney. We had, you know, Anna Marie Jagos there. Mm. It was like a really big...
lesbianism at the time, you know.
But it was a very big queer theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Surge there. I don't know how she avoided it. But she must have. So LGBTI people learn their identity from a textbook. That's her contention, that they didn't, that their identities were naturally acquired.
Hmm.
No. Okay, so, like, if you want to be all eugenicist about it, you can say that we're born with particular sexual urges. I suspect that that may not be the case. But let's just pretend that at some point in the future we will find differences between the male and female brain and the gay and the straight brain, et cetera, et cetera. For me, it doesn't really matter whether that will be shown. But to say that you acquire identity naturally, this from a cultural studies scholar, what the fuck?
Yeah,
that's, like,
amazing. Seems hard to take.
How can she say that? She's an academic. She lived through cultural studies. Like, people don't learn their identities. Yes, they absolutely do.
And again, it sort of goes back to what we've been... I mean, a lot of the theme of this conversation are that sort of individualization of identities, which is natural, of course. A lack of understanding about the political nature of identities and the cultural nature of identities and the social nature of identities, that we live in society and in politics, and that has an impact on those sorts of things.
But it just... I mean, I don't know how much political action is... possible in this era between queers, you know? I mean, for me, like, it's sort of like the older I get, the more practically minded I get, I suppose. And I no longer believe in me. I mean, I worked in sort of fairly mainstream media for a long time, and I'm pretty confident I never changed a single person with my inspirational talk about strong women. Of course, you know, there's a lot of people that believe that not to be the case, and they think that these sort of short sugar rushes that essentially come from, you know, popular liberal feminists are going to transform the lives of women. I don't think that that happens. You know, you get a frisson, you know, but what really changes is interaction with others. And I think that the interaction with others, you know, has to be as comrades and not as within, you know, like a true left-wing context. And that is the true viable context that is emerging. We read so much in the press at the moment about the alt-right, and of course they've done terrible things, but what we don't read about is, you know, the strong and growing like ultra left, hard left, historical materialist movements happening all over Europe and in America. And you know, like Chapo Trap House, you know, that podcast, it's massive now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, I mean, Podemos, Insoumi, you know, Syriza, okay, sure, they've been disappointing, and so's the SNP, Corbyn. This is the counter narrative to these conservative times, and it's, you know, young leftist people, about which I write in my new book, Total Propaganda, Basic Marxist Brainwashing for the Angry and the Young. Sorry. But this is the true counter movement, and it is much bigger. I mean, you get what, like 500,000 people, mostly under 30, joining UK Labour for Jeremy Corbyn, making it the biggest political party in Europe, the youngest political party in Europe, and yet we're fixated on the right as the source of all trouble with no regard for the fact that, and it's quite diverse, you know, culturally, ethnically diverse membership as well, without looking at what is actually happening. I mean, Sanders is not perfect. Again, his audiences were really diverse. So I think it's more of a case of comrades understanding, you know, what problems are specific to your identity group and how can we stand shoulder to shoulder and fight together for, you know, needs that, that suit us all. But I mean, I've given up on queers. I mean, they're just so fucking boring.
I mean, it sounds like you were saying that at best we could have a, like, you know, your understanding of your own experience through being queer could be a pathway into a broader kind of left politics for a lot of people.
Yeah, but when does that happen? Like, you two guys.
Sure. Sure. Well, you know, I'm sure we're not the only ones, hopefully.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, look, increasingly, like, one of my favourite writers is, you know, Yasmin Nair.
Yeah.
From Against Equality. Yeah. Against Equality are amazing. And yes, she is such an extraordinary writer as well. I'm jealous of everything that woman writes. And certainly, you know, her experience as being, you know, like a Desi woman and a queer woman living in a Western country, of course, all those things inform. But, you know, and, yeah, the stuff that, I mean, you know, I just highly recommend that you, if you're so inclined and if you're not going to troll, join the Against Equality conversation group on Facebook or definitely look at their resources online. And their major areas of activism. And remember, marriage equality has happened in a very different way in the US.
Yes, of course.
To what it has here. Like, you kind of have to be married in the US to have certain legal rights, and that's not the case in Australia, either for same or opposite sex couples. And in a way, it's actually forcing people to get married. So, you know, if you want insurance, you have to get married, et cetera. Incarceration is a really big deal for Against Equality. And, you know, it's a real weird thing I've seen happen. Like, there's people aware that, you know, that there needs to be reform, especially where trans people are concerned, and trans people are much more likely to be incarcerated than many other, you know, than the general population. And so what happens is, you know, a lot of, like, good people go and talk to corrective officers who are on low wages in what are often profit-making companies and tell them, don't be mean to trans people, rather than kind of like going back to the root and asking why are, you know, trans people criminalised? Like, you know, and why are Aboriginal people criminalised? It's like, is it just because they're bad people? No, I don't think so. You know, it's the economic conditions of their lives. So it's sort of like, you know, waiting for the dead bodies and kind of like giving them a good funeral rather than you actually ensuring that, but this is an awful analogy, but actually ensuring that, you know, people have good lives from the outset. So I see this more as a pan-leftist movement. I understand that, you know, traditionally there's been really homophobic people on the material left and really sexist people and really racist people. So here's my moment of optimism. The one great thing that identity politics has given us is 40 years on the left of thinking about how we might step on somebody's toes with inconsiderate language. Mm. None of that shit is bad. I mean, in many ways, these are the true problems. But so we've got that. And now we also have a group of young people who are very aware of all of these things, but are also now embracing historical materialism. That is the way in which the mode of production, which ours is capital, transforms people's lives. So what we have are these kids who are becoming, who are very identity politics aware and are very Marxist. Plus, the world is in a state of economic shit. I would say that the conditions for meaningful revolution amongst all people are pretty good at the moment. I mean, yeah, I will thank identity politics for the last 40 years, whether it was the result of neoliberalism or not, for actually educating us all to the point where we don't say dumb shit and we don't diminish people by using the wrong word and what have you. So this, to me, is like a perfect concatenation for real amazing activism. I don't hate black people and also, I hate capitalism. What more could a girl ask, you know? I mean, this is, for me, a time where not people of my age range, but more people of your age range and younger might actually be able to find, like, a truer and richer solidarity.
That sounds like a perfect place to stop. Just so all of our listeners know, Helen is speaking at the Festival of Questions on Sunday, the 15th of October.
She also has a marvellous new book out.
Yes, and she has a marvellous new book out called...
Total Propaganda.
And so you should all check that out. Talking about Marxism, it's kind of an introduction to Marxism, isn't it, for young people?
It is.
Yeah, so sounds like a really great, if you want to sort of go more into Marxism and how young people can be, you know, energised by Marxism, I think that sounds like excellent.
You can put this episode into practice.
Yeah, put this episode into practice. Well, yeah. But otherwise, like, Helen, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
When we managed to be in Melbourne at the same time, and it was been a great chat.
Yes, lovely.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you all for listening. We will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode.
In the meantime, you can check out our podcast at queers.podomatic.com and go and subscribe to us on iTunes. And as always, please leave a review and rating as that helps other people find us.
Even better, you should tell friends if you think you have any friends that would be interested in listening to the podcast. Tell them to listen to it. That's word of mouth is a really great way we get new listeners. You can also email us if you have any questions or comments or feedback. We're at queerspodcast@gmail.com.
And we're now on Facebook and Twitter. Yay, at Queers Podcast. So go and check out our Facebook and Twitter feeds. And I'm on Twitter at Simon Copland and on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer. And Ben is on Twitter at Ben C. Riley.
Buy my book.
Buy Helen's book. One more time the name.
Total Propaganda.
Excellent. Go buy it.
Check it out. Thanks as always for listening, and we will see you next time.